For those of you that might have stepped in a little later, there's an email list if you're interested in receiving emails from the group. Please be sure to do that before you leave, and there's also a little flyer on a contact hour, one contact hour for nursing related to mercury toxicity and fish consumption. Okay. Next is another friend of mine, actually John and I met, and this was not in your little bio, at the Environmental Protection Agency's Children's Children's Health Protection Advisory Committee is where I first met John. Dr. Belbus is currently a senior research scientist in the Department of Global Health at George Washington University School of Public Health and Health Services. From 2002 until 2009, he was the Health Program Director and Chief Health Scientist for Environmental Defense Fund. He will soon begin a position as Senior Public Health Advisor for the National Institute of Environmental Health Sciences. Congratulations to John, and that's good news for us. He has authored studies and lectures on global climate change and health, transportation-related air pollution, the toxic effects of chemicals and regulatory approaches to protecting susceptible populations. John is a member of the EPA Science Advisory Board and the National Research Council's Board on Environmental Studies and Toxicology. He received his AB degree in biochemistry from Harvard, his MD from University of Pennsylvania, and his MPH from the Johns Hopkins School of Public Health. Please help me welcome Dr. John Belbus.
Thank you very much, Laura. Good afternoon, everybody. I want to start by thanking the nurses in the room, both as individuals for all you guys have been doing and also as a professional organization, because the American Nurses Association is right on the ball, helping support letters, signing on to letters, active, engaged, and whoever is, there's probably somebody in this room who's making that happen. And I just want to thank you because there's really good stuff going on. How many people were here a year ago when I spoke? So a lot of you, okay. I want to start by winding back the clock and remembering where we were a year ago. The date was, I think, October 30th. It wasn't a November APHA, it was an October 30th. And it had been a real landmark 6 months for climate change and public health. It was amazing. We had the National Public Health Week was on climate change, APHA, and that was a big deal. World Health Organization World Health Day was on climate change. We had a series of hearings in Congress. Both houses of Congress were having hearings and testimony on climate change and health. And we had the EPA starting to release and kind of give some of their information on what was going to happen with something I'll talk about later, an endangerment finding. All of a sudden, the world had really changed a year ago. There was a tremendous amount of momentum being built on climate change and health. And yet, at the same time, there was a whole lot of uncertainty. EPA had denied a very important waiver that I'm going to talk about in a little bit. And the other thing that was going on in October 30th, it was in the midst. I mean, our portfolios were actually in a little better shape in October 30th than they were, you know, 6 months later. There was a big financial crisis going on. You know, September was really when the markets collapsed. So that's where we were a year ago. And now let's talk about where we are now. And this was the first big change that happened, right? And this has enabled this and the change in Congress that went along with the election of President Obama has really changed the game again. And so what I'm going to be telling you about that's going on a national level is in some ways even more exciting than where we were a year ago, because there's been really tremendous progress. And at the same time, disappointments, frustrations, and still challenges for all of us to actually accomplish what we are trying to accomplish. So what I'm going to do is just go through some remarkable things that have happened. In March of last year, Representative Louise Slaughter from California, who is in hers, right? Do you guys know Representative Slaughter? This all started with a wonderful nurse in Congress who decided that her issue was going to be climate change and health. And she actually came to the American Public Health Association, said, I want to do something here. And so we worked together and we wrote a bill on climate change and health. And the timing was just right to get that bill, which was introduced as a standalone bill, put into the big climate bill that was going through the House. Now, there are three rules on naming a bill in Congress. The first rule is that it has to have a lot of sexy buzzwords that will be really good politically for, you know, Fox News and CNBC. The second is it has to have some kind of wacky acronym, you know, so it all has to go together. So this was the ACES bill. And the third rule is that it has to say virtually nothing about what it really is about. Okay. So the House bill was the ACES bill, the American Clean Energy and Security Bill, all good buzzwords. But what was remarkable is that in its 800 pages, there are about 15 pages that set up a public health system for climate change and health. So this is a bill that has requires the Department of Health and Human Services to create a national plan, to set up an advisory board, to look at and do a quick needs assessment for climate change and health of the United States, report back on it. And it also creates something called the Climate Health Protection and Promotion Fund. So we were able to get a share of the pie of the cap and trade program that's going to be generating tremendous amounts of revenue out of this effort to reduce greenhouse gases. The amount doesn't sound like a lot. We're actually only getting, in the House bill, 0.1%. That's compared to, 4% for wildlife adaptation, 3.9% for the rest of domestic adaptation. I think that's probably a little on the low side, but nonetheless, 0.1% is probably going to be somewhere in the $50, $60, $70, $80 million a year range, which is several times where we are right now, at least. So that passed the House in May, and there was a whole lot of momentum going on for climate legislation. We thought, boy, we're going to have this all done by the end of the summer, and then, of course, healthcare reform happened. But now we have a new bill in the Senate, and as you know, there's going to be a bill in the House and then a bill in the Senate, and then they'll have to come together in conference and figure out what the ultimate bill is. So the bill in the Senate is the Clean Energy, we got those words in, Jobs, we forgot about jobs the first time, and American Power Act, which has kind of a Star Wars-like acronym. They blew the acronym part of that, CJABA. So there was some talk that all of the good things that we had done for public health might disappear. The Senate wasn't really too into this. But in fact, the language that is in the Senate bill is nearly identical except for two very, two relatively important differences. One difference is that the House had little language in there, little technicality that said that the funding for this public health protection had to be renewed every year in Congress, which is like a hurdle that would have to be passed. And in fact, the Senate bill says the opposite, says no hurdles, it's just there. So that's good news. The bad news, or the good news, is that there is no amount. It's 0.1% in the House. There's no mention of percentage in the Senate. So that's going to be, this has just been introduced, and it just passed out of committee. You may have heard about this. So it's still working its way through the Senate, and now the Finance Committee is probably going to determine these amounts. So, in a year's time, we've gone from being really excited that we had Public Health Week to actually having federal climate legislation addressing public health, a sense of Congress about public health, funds behind public health, and infrastructure to support everything that Sarah was talking about, all these state adaptation efforts. So that's what's going on the federal legislation level. Let me talk a little bit about the federal regulation level. And just to backtrack a little bit, and I'm sorry, it's 5 o'clock and this is gonna get, I'm gonna try to keep it from wallowing in the completely arcane, but I just want you to kind of understand what the word, what people are talking about. It's kind of, you have to understand the news, you have to kind of understand some arcane stuff. So the whole regulatory battle with the EPA hinged around a really bad decision that was made. There is a provision of the Clean Air Act that dates way back to the 60s and 70s that said if California wants to do something more stringent than the rest of the government, damn it, they can, because they have really bad air pollution. And it's called a waiver, and it's written into the Clean Air Act that if California wants to pass a more stringent regulation, EPA can just, because otherwise the Clean Air Act says everybody has to be the same, no state can go off. That was a so that industry doesn't freak out that every state has a different bill. California has special status. It's been used 40 times, denied once, I think, in its entire history. The last administration, so California came to the EPA in 2005 and said, we want to regulate greenhouse gases more stringently than the federal government, which means anything would have been more stringent than the federal government, of course. Will you give us a waiver? And they presented their argument, and the administration said, no, no waiver, can't regulate greenhouse gases. Greenhouse gases really are not air pollution as far as we're concerned. That was kind of their justification. It's not air pollution under the Clean Air Act. So many of you probably know that in there was a lawsuit that came from this. Massachusetts was led the group of states. Their name is on this lawsuit. And the Supreme Court overturned this waiver and said to the EPA in 2007, they said, you blew it. We think, the Supreme Court, that greenhouse gases actually do qualify as air pollutants under the Clean Air Act. You need to go back and look at this waiver again. So it's arcane, but this has really been the crux of the whole regulatory issue is, are greenhouse gases, is carbon dioxide an air pollutant? Because if it isn't, then there's no regulation. If there is, then this gives the EPA the opportunity to start saying, well, we're going to start regulating, and it creates a lot more chance for success for good, stringent controls on greenhouse gases in any bill that would come by. Because if there's no threat of regulation from EPA, then the more conservative forces in Congress are just going to stop any bill because they can. So, a little bit of background. In order to regulate under the Clean Air Act, there have to be two regulatory findings. And this is where public health people start coming in. The first is what's called an endangerment finding. And this is language in the Clean Air Act that says, in order to regulate an air pollutant, EPA has to say that it's bad for people. Pretty straightforward. Should be pretty straightforward when it came to greenhouse gases. This was a long time coming. EPA put together a lot of information, did some really good reports. In April of 2009, they released kind of the proposed finding. They took public comment for a couple months, and now it's ready to go final. It's kind of been a lot of time, and I don't know what's going on, but we are expecting at some point this final finding on endangerment should be coming out. The second piece of this is called a cause or contribute finding. So first you have to say it's bad for people, and then you have to say that a given source causes or contributes to this harm that comes from this air pollutant. And so the whole California thing was hinging around automobiles. So this is a finding that had to be made that said that motor vehicles, that the emissions that come out of cars and trucks, cause or contribute to the overall problem of climate change and the health harm that comes from that. Again, should be a bit of a no-brainer. American transportation accounts for 4% of the entire world's greenhouse gases and about 25% of the United States. So this was something that, again, relatively straightforward. EPA didn't have trouble making this finding. Put it out in April of 2009 for public comment, and again, we're waiting on the finalization of that. While waiting for that whole finalization, the Administrator Jackson rewind for a second. In January of 2009, the day after the inauguration of President Obama, Governor Schwarzenegger wrote a letter to President Obama and said, hey, there was this really stupid decision that was made. I don't think he used the word stupid, but there was this decision that was made, and we would like you to think about it again and see if you still agree with it. And so EPA went back, thought about it for a record short time, I think, for EPA, and in June 30th, 2009, that waiver was granted. So setting the way for California to move ahead. There are a couple of more things that are cooking along on the regulatory front. And again, I bring this up again so you understand kind of that there's a lot of activity going, that this is forcing activity on all fronts. And, most importantly, as public health people, we recognize that when things are put in place that are emission standards for greenhouse gases, this is going to go along with emissions reductions for a lot of conventional air pollutants and have cascading health benefits, if it's done right, especially. This concept was actually used to less positive effect when, in the mercury rule, the EPA decided, well, if we reduce all the other air pollutants, we'll take out some of the mercury too. So our rule for mercury will say for the next 15 years, you don't have to do anything about mercury because we're reducing it anyway for these other things. It was using this idea that there's kind of co-reductions in different kinds of pollutants. But we have an opportunity here to really emphasize the ability to reduce conventional air pollutants and get some benefits. So EPA is moving forward. There's a lot of activity going on. And EPA is moving forward with regulations for automobiles. They just released a new set of fuel economy standards that ramped up a little bit what had come out about a year previously, and kind of moved the timeline forward. And then EPA is also moving forward on regulating greenhouse gases from large industrial facilities. Setting a threshold so that there isn't this talk about regulating, you know, mom and pop operations and regulating, you know, the fireplace in your house, which was some of the talk when this came out. So more than 25,000 tons of carbon dioxide a year. What they're basically going to do is use the technical permitting process that's required for, you know, all large industrial facilities to certify they're not putting out too much nitrogen oxide or sulfur dioxide. They're going to be adding in emission requirements for carbon dioxide as well on that. So that is a lot. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is a huge amount of activity, a huge amount of work, and as I'm going to comment at the end, it's going to require a huge lot of support. So a lot in a year, and something else really big is happening pretty soon. Anybody know where that is? That's the Little Mermaid from Copenhagen. So there was a lot of hope in our community, you know, 11 months and 2 weeks ago, that the timing was such that we would, as a country, be going into Copenhagen with a new look, with a clear indication that we were ready to assume world leadership, with a clear indication that the country was behind strong action on climate change. And, you know, that would have opened the doors for, you know, a lot going on there that would have been both on the, you know, the climate change mitigation front and also on the health front. Unfortunately, we're not there, and we're not there for a lot of reasons, not the least of which are the economic meltdown and the need to address that both ethically, morally, politically, for all reasons, and of course other priorities that have come up, like healthcare reform. So what's going on? And I'll be honest with you, I mean, I'm not on the inside, and so I can only kind of ask around. But when I ask around, I don't get a lot of answers. I think that, in terms of position and in terms of, you know, being able to go in to Copenhagen with climate legislation with a clear idea of what the United States is doing, there's still a lot of question marks about what's going to happen. From a health standpoint, there's a couple of things going on. One is that the health community, including, he was here a second ago, including Healthcare Without Harm and the Health Environmental Alliance, I think it's called, which is a consortium of European NGOs, is organizing the healthcare organizations, health professional organizations, public health organizations, to get mobilized and to really start speaking out and supporting not just the health part of climate change, but greenhouse gas reduction measures, really calling for strong reductions to try to achieve the targets that have been set out by the IPCC, et cetera. So that's going on. There's a letter that's gone out. That's one of the letters that the ANA has signed, and there will be continuing activity trying to get the health voice calling out for strong controls. There will be side events on climate change impacts of human health, but I'm going to have to just unfortunately close on a little bit of a shrug and a question mark, because there are a lot of other issues that need to be addressed at this level. Health adaptation for developing countries, for emerging economies. This is where the climate impacts are already becoming to become very serious. I'm sure it will be on the table I just haven't heard where the United States is on that. I think that is an area, again, where those of us in the room, the organizations represented in the room, can start speaking out and pushing the United States on action. So, we've come a long way. It's really been a remarkable couple of years, if you think about it. I've been at this for 16 years, and it was 14 years of almost nothing and 2 years of some very quick action, from a policy standpoint, certainly. But there's also a lot of challenges. There's a lot of work that needs to be done. And so there's a lot of opportunities for advocacy from the health sector. Lots of need for the health organizations to be speaking out, making themselves heard about these bills, about the regulations, about the need for this. And this is going on. It's being organized in a couple different fronts that I've seen. We really need support from the public health community for the public health piece of these two climate bills as this goes to conference. I was really nervous about that. I'm starting to get more, well, it's probably bad, that's why I'm saying we have to do something about it. I'm getting a little more hopeful that this is viewed as 0.1% and it's viewed as, you know, it's health. I mean, it's viewed as something that they can do and not gore the ox of some special interest. And so I think it will be something that will stay in by and large, but we need to make sure that it gets finalized in as good shape as it can, without the hurdles every year, with as much of a share as we can get. And then the last thing is just the other opportunity that we need to keep in mind is for the healthcare sector to keep working on its own green image, greening itself, showing that it's feasible. We're a very energy-intensive sector. I haven't talked about this very much, but you know, as these restrictions come in, there will be a need for every sector to demonstrate it can be done, and I think the healthcare sector is getting on the ball, but I think there's a lot that we can do to help that happen. So that's my update. Thanks very much.